Ernard's head turned to one side, and he released the garum with one arm, seizing its tail. The beast rolled wildly, twisting free of Bernard's grip, and scrambled at the forest floor with its powerful legs to rise and sink its teeth into Amara's husband. Bernard, though, had found his feet first, and hauled at the garum's tail before it could regain its balance. It scrambled toward him as best it could, and Bernard shuffled away from the jaws, still hauling hard on the tail. At first, Amara thought he was simply trying to buy time, but by the second circle, the garum began to pick up speed. The beast was the largest of any Amara had seen, and must have weighed 500 pounds if it weighed an ounce, but the Count of Calderon whirled it up off the ground as if it were a child's toy. Pivoting in a great circle, Bernard roared in rage and triumph, and slammed the garum's skull against the thick trunk of a tree. It broke with a wet, hollow thunk, like the sound of a melon being smashed open, and the lizard fell to the earth, abruptly and totally limp. The garum trapped in the willow snarled and tore its way free of the grasping limbs and fell to the ground behind Bernard. Amara cried out in a wordless warning. He looked up at her, and then his head whipped around. He flung out his hand and cried, "Brutus!" The earth beneath the garum suddenly shuddered and erupted into motion. The shape of a hound the size of a small horse rose from the earth, its shoulders and chest made of flint and loam, its eyes of glittering green gems, its jaws of granite. Bernard's earth fury seized the garum in its stony maw, and the lizard hissed and thrashed wildly as Brutus lifted the lizard entirely off the ground. The great hound continued rising from the ground like a dog emerging from the waters of a lake, and shook the garum as a terrier would a rat. Amara thought she heard the lizard's neck snap, but Brutus was not satisfied until he had slammed the garum against two trees and repeatedly hammered it into the ground. By the time the earth fury was finished, the garum was a bloody mass of pulped flesh and shattered bone. Amara slowed and came to a halt a few feet away from her husband. Bernard watched until Brutus was finished, then nodded and said, "Thank you." The stone hound champed its jaws twice, shook its head, sending pebbles and bits of mud flying, and sank down into the earth again, turning circles like a dog about to lie down as it went. Bernard sagged and dropped to one knee. Amara rushed to his side. "Bernard?"
"It's nothing, I'm fine,"
Bernard slurred, still breathing heavily.
"Gaius?"
"He's alive," Amara said. "Let me see your head."
"Looks worse than it is,"
Bernard said.
"Scalp wounds bleed a lot, flesh wound."
"I know that," Amara said. "But you've got a lump the size of an egg to go with the cut. Concussions are not flesh wounds." Bernard reached up and caught her hand. He met her eyes and said in a quiet, firm tone,
"See to the First Lord, Countess."
She stiffened with anger. "Bernard."
"I have a duty to my lord. So do you."
"I also have a duty to my husband," she whispered back. Bernard released her hand and growled,
"See to Gaius."
His tone became gentler and very tired.
"You know I'm right."
She put a hand to her face for a moment, took a deep breath, then touched his head gently. Then she turned and went back to the First Lord. Gaius lay on the ground with his eyes closed. He opened them as Amara approached and said,
"I haven't done that in a while."
"Sire?"
"Hunted garum. Not since I was about 17.
He exhaled heavily.
"It was considerably less strenuous back then."
His voice was tight with pain, the way it had been at the beginning of their journey. "You're hurt."
"It's my leg," he said quietly. "The good one."
He nodded at the still twitching garum.
"I'm afraid this fellow managed to trap it between his hide and a stone. I'm fairly sure it's broken."
Amara bent to examine the First Lord's leg. It was swollen, and his foot rested at an utterly inappropriate angle to the rest of the leg. It had been a twisting break, not a clean snap of the bone. Amara knew that they could be very ugly.
"I can't see any bone poking out," she said quietly. "You aren't bleeding. How bad is it?"
"It's only pain," Gaius said, but his voice trembled as he did. "I see that Bernard gave rather a good accounting of himself."
Amara would need to set the leg as soon as possible. They would have to splint it as well.
"He killed three of them."
"For killing men, metal crafters stand supreme," Gaius murmured. "But beasts don't fight like men. Primal. Savage. For them, nothing replaces raw strength. And I think one really couldn't fault my choice in companions on this particular journey."
He shook his head and blinked his eyes several times.
"I'm babbling. Please excuse me. The mind tends to wander a bit when one is my age. Or in excruciating pain."
"We'll do what we can, sire," Amara said.
"The pain won't kill me. Bernard is bleeding. See to him. I believe I'll faint now if it isn't too inconvenient."
The First Lord fell silent, and Amara bent to him for a panicked instant. He continued breathing steadily, though, and his pulse was strong. She bit her lip in sympathy and was just as glad that he had lost consciousness. His injury had to be pure torment. She took off her cloak, damp as it was, rolled it up and used it to support his broken leg. Then she rose and went back to Bernard. He had taken off his pack and was fumbling through it rather dazedly. Amara took it from his hands and removed the box of bandages, ointments, and healing salves he carried in it. She cleaned his wound as best she could, but it kept bleeding, as such injuries tended to.
"This will need stitches to close properly," she said quietly. "That means we'll need boiling water, a fire."
"Dangerous," Bernard mumbled. "Too easy to spot."
"We've little choice," she replied. "He's unconscious. His leg is broken. We have to warm him up, then set the leg. Can you have Brutus make a shelter for us?"
He looked at her dully for a moment, and then back at Gaius.
"Dangerous."
She put her hands on either side of his face.
"Bernard, you've been hit in the head. You're having trouble speaking clearly, much less thinking clearly. I need you to trust me. This is necessary."
He exhaled heavily and closed his eyes. Then he nodded. He opened his eyes again and peered blearily around them through the rain. Then he nodded at a hillock and muttered under his breath.
"Garum had a den there. Brutus is widening it, shoring it up. Drag wood in first thing. Let it start to dry. Then we'll move Gaius in."
"Very well," Amara said.
She covered his wound with a pad of folded cloth and wound a bandage around his head to hold it closed as best it could until she could see to the injury more thoroughly.
"Bernard, it's his good leg that's broken."
Bernard frowned for a moment, then said,
"Crows, he won't be able to walk."
"No,"
Amara said.
"That's bad," he said.
"Yes."
"But there is good news," he said.
She frowned at him. His nostrils flared as he inhaled.
"Smell that?"
Amara frowned and sniffed at the air. There was an overripe smell to it, a vegetable reek.
"Only one thing smells like that," Bernard said. "Swamps. We made it. Once we get in there, don't have to worry about our back trail."
"No," Amara murmured. "Only disease, injury, lack of food, and more of those garim."
Bernard grunted.
"Well," he mused, "we never did get that honeymoon."
Amara blinked at him for a moment, then burst out in a laugh that surprised her with its depth and strength. He gave her a weary grin, and for a moment his eyes shone with warmth.
"That's better. Love it when you smile."
Then he took a deep breath and pushed himself slowly to his feet. He touched the bandages and hissed in discomfort.
"Don't do that," Amara said absently.
She rose, wincing at a flare of pain in her back. She'd almost forgotten the blow from the Garim's tail and the tumble afterward. Her muscles and bones, however, had not. "He can't walk," she said quietly. "What are we going to do?"
"We'll handle it, Countess. One thing at a time."
She touched her face and then the bandages.
"I love you very much, you know."
He lifted her fingers from his head and kissed them gently, eyes sparkling.
"Who could blame you?"
Amara laughed again. Chapter 29.
"Again!" Araris snapped, driving a series of high, whirling slashes at Tavi's head. The Singulare was not restraining the force of his blows, and it took every ounce of Tavi's concentration and skill to survive them. He found the rhythm of the attack, found the tiny half-beat of vulnerability between one of Araris's strikes and the next, and countered low, his body dipping to one side and out of the line of the attack. One hand resting flat on the ground to support his suddenly altered balance, his blade darting in a swift thrust for the large artery in the Singulare's midsection. Tavi was an instant too slow. Arara slammed his blade across Tavi's, driving it from his fingers. The Singulare swung a booted kick at Tavi's face. Tavi rolled away from it. Araris drove his heel down at Tavi's nose. Tavi swatted the blow mostly aside and found the point of Araris's sword resting in the hollow of his throat. Araris stared at Tavi, his eyes expressionless, even frightening. Then he drew himself upright and lifted the sword away.
"It has to be faster," he said quietly. "The fight is always in motion. You can't wait for the right beat. You have to anticipate it."
Tavi scowled up at Araris.
"We've done this every day for a week. It's only one counter. Someone my size is going to have real trouble using it. We both know that. What happened to fighting to my strengths?"
"This is one," Araris said. "You just don't know it yet."
Tavi shook his head.
"What the crows is that supposed to mean?"
Araris rested a hand on his midsection where he'd been wounded, wincing like a man with a stitch in his side after a long run.
"Any swordsman worth the name won't expect that move from someone like you. They would think it too dangerous, too foolhardy."
Tavi touched his throat where Araris's sword had been and glanced at the small smear of blood on his finger.
"Why would anyone think that?"
But he got to his feet, recovered his sword, and faced Araris, ready to go again. Araris rolled his shoulder, his expression pained, and shook his head.
"Enough for today."
They lifted their blades in a mutual salute and put them away.
"Is your side still hurting? Maybe I should get the steadholder to—"
"No," Araris said at once. "No. She has enough to contend with. It's sore, that's all."
Tavi arched his eyebrows, realization dawning in his face.
"That's how Navaris got you."
Araris frowned and looked away. "She had too many of Varnus's singulares with her. I couldn't have fought them all and lived. So I gave Navaris an opening. I had counted on her to take a thrust to my leg and pin her sword in the hull for a moment."
He waved a hand at his flank.
"But she hit me here instead."
Tavi frowned.
"I saw her sword go through the hull, but it was still stuck there when—"
His voice trailed off as a little surge of nausea went through his stomach. Araris had been pinned to the Mactus's hull with a sword through his guts. The only way he could have freed himself would have been—
Bloody crows!
The man had simply sliced himself free on Navaris's weapon. He'd let the blade cut through 4 or 5 inches of his own midsection. No wonder it looked like Navaris had slashed him open halfway to his spine. Araris met Tavi's gaze soberly and nodded.
"Without Isana," he shrugged.
"Navaris shouldn't have been able to do that. I don't know how she managed it, but she did. I'm pushing us both."
He turned without another word and went back to the ship's cabin. Tavi put his sword away, tugged on his loose tunic, and made his way thoughtfully to the ship's prow. After their raid on the doomed Mactus, the rest of the voyage had been comparatively uneventful, and Tavi found himself growing increasingly anxious. Araris was back on his feet after 2 days of rest, and they returned to relentless practice on the deck for hours at a time. Araris proved to be one of those swordmasters who believed that pain was the best motivator for learning. Tavi acquired any number of small cuts, some of them quite messy and painful, and a collection of dozens of bruises in various colours. Despite the pain, the practice sessions helped. He wasn't sure exactly how well he was progressing in his swordsmanship, since Araris always seemed to be just a bit faster than Tavi, his technique and positioning a tiny bit more precise than Tavi's own. But Araris assured him that he was getting better. The practices were exhausting, which Tavi thought was their single largest benefit. It left him with less energy to worry about the future. After dinner that night, he was standing at the prow of the ship again, watching dolphins sport in the waters ahead of the Slive. Kitai was lying back along a line, somewhere above him and behind him, relaxing as casually as if it had been a hammock, rather than a single rope she held with an ankle and one hand. He could feel her lazy contentment at having a full belly, an interesting day, and a lovely sunset to watch over the rolling waves of the sea. Tavi closed his eyes and tried to partake of Kitai's contentment. The two of them differed fundamentally in regards to their views on the future. For Kitai, the future was a single enormous matter of relative unimportance. What mattered was the here and now. While preparation for what might happen was useful, it was beneficial more in how it shaped one's character and brightened one's day than for any practical gain it might grant when the future became the present. Kitai, he knew, approved of Tavi's weapons training with Araris, but he suspected it had more to do with the fact that she enjoyed seeing him sweating and shirtless than with her concern for whom he might be fighting in the future. Tavi's sense of Kitai changed slightly as her interest was briefly piqued. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Aaron approaching.
"Hey," Tavi said quietly.
"Hey," Aaron said. The little cursor came up to stand beside Tavi, staring out ahead of the ship.
"I talked to Deimos. We start up the Gaul tomorrow. After that it will be another week to get up the river to the capital. Maybe more if he can't find a decent tugboat."
Tavi nodded.
"That's good. I figure we'll be there right around the time of the new moon."
"Always nice for sneaking around, springing prisoners," Aaron said.
There was tension in the former scribe's shoulders. He folded his arms and leaned one hip against the rail.
"I knew she was a skilled healer, but I didn't know the Steadholder's other watercraft was that strong. It surprised me."
"I think it surprised her, too," Tavi said. "Maybe it shouldn't have. She flooded a river at home just before Second Calderon. That's more than most watercrafters can do."
Aaron nodded. "How is she?"
"Araris hung up a hammock for her in a storage room in the hold. She says it's quieter down there. She was up on deck for a while earlier. I'd say she's getting a handle on it now."
"That's good," Aaron said.
He frowned out at the sea and his voice trailed away into an awkward silence.
"Just say it," Tavi said quietly.
"Say what?"
Aaron asked. "Whatever it is that's bothering you."
Aaron quirked one corner of his mouth up and nodded, staring out to sea.
"When we went over to the Mactus, you said something to the Steadholder."
Tavi grimaced.
"I was sort of hoping you wouldn't notice it in all the excitement."
"I debated doing that," Aaron said. "But these days it seems I have to lie to almost everyone. I don't really like it, and I don't want that to include you."
Tavi smiled a little and nodded.
"Thank you."
"Sure,"
Aaron said.
"So, when you told Isana that she was the First Lady of Alera, what you meant was..."
"Exactly what I said," Tavi said.
Aaron frowned. Then he blinked and stared at Tavi.
"You mean she's really Lady Caria? In disguise?"
Tavi blinked.
"What? No! Oh, bloody crows, no!"
Aaron frowned.
"Then I don't get it.
The First Lady is the wife of the First Lord.
Most First Lords would have retired years ago, Tavi said. Passed their authority on to their heir. Remained as an advisor, maybe.
Aaron frowned. Then he lifted both eyebrows and dropped his voice to a whisper.
The Princeps? Gaius Septimus?
Tavi nodded silently.
But he never married.
He did, Tavi said. Legally. And he left her the means to prove it.
Aaron whistled.
If he'd lived,
he shook his head. Well, everything would be different, wouldn't it?
Aaron studied Tavi's face for a moment, frowning.
But that's not all. Tavi took a deep breath.
He had an heir by her, Aaron. A son.
The cursor arched a skeptical eyebrow. An heir to the crown? Tavi...
Then his expression froze in place.
Tavi, he said quietly, his eyes widening. Tavi forced himself to smile a little. He shrugged his shoulders stiffly.
I'm not terribly comfortable with it either.
Aaron glanced around covertly. How many people know about this?
You, Cyril, Araris, my mother.
And me, Kitai drawled from her perch without opening her eyes. Tavi frowned up at her.
I never explained it to you.
She yawned. Alaren, please. It is not as if you are horribly complex. I have ears and a mind. If I waited for you to speak to me about everything important, it would probably drive me insane.
Tavi snorted and shook his head. He turned back to Aaron. The young man chewed idly at a fingernail, a habit Tavi remembered well from their days at the academy together.
Gaius doesn't know?
He knows something, Tavi said. I'm not sure how much.
Aaron sighed. You realize that it's my duty to inform him.
That, Tavi said, is the least of my worries.
The cursor nodded. If it's true, he said. Tavi, I don't mean to insult you, but an heir of the House of Gaius would be a powerful fury crafter. You aren't.
There are reasons, Tavi said quietly. I don't want to go into it right now.
The cursor nodded and looked away. After a minute he asked, his voice carrying a slight edge, How long have you known?
You're my friend, Aaron. I don't want to have to lie to you either.
Tavi turned to him and put a hand on Aaron's shoulder, meeting his eyes.
I found out just before we marched out from the Ellen Arch. Until then I had no idea.
Aaron searched his eyes for a moment, a line appearing between his eyebrows. Then he nodded slowly. All right. He chewed on another fingernail. So, what do we do?
We continue with the mission, Tavi said. We get Varg and use him to broker an armistice with the Khanim. Then we march south and help Sir Miles put Kalaris down for good.
Simultaneously stealing the thunder from both Aquitanus and his puppet Arnos.
Aaron shook his head.
You can't expose yourself to this kind of risk.
What risk? I'm not anything yet, Tavi said. And even if I was, it has to be me who takes the risk. Who else could?
Aaron rolled his eyes and waved his hands in a vague gesture of frustration. How can you possibly say something that is so backward while still making sense?
Tavi laughed. The point is, he said, we've got to focus on what's here and now. Have you gone over the list?
Aaron nodded. I can buy everything but the cold stones. Those aren't easy to find at any time, much less in the spring. Everyone's saving them up for summer. Even if I find some for sale, they're going to cost more than we have.
They aren't optional equipment, Tavi said, frowning. We've got to have them, period.
I thought you'd say something like that, Aaron said. He glanced up at the rigging above and behind them. As it happens... I seem to remember a rather successful burglar who terrorized the shopkeepers of the capital a few years back.
Kitai opened one eye. Her mouth spread into her lazy feline grin.
"Good," she said. "I was beginning to grow bored."
Chapter 30. At Tavi's insistence, backed by more of Cyril's coin, Captain Deimos hired a particularly swift tugboat for the journey upriver once they had reached Pasia. Tavi had never been to the southern city and seaport at the delta of the Gaul, but there was no time to take in the sights. Pasia was a city of shining white stone, rising on several tiered levels almost like stair steps, up to an impressive fortified citadel. Though not as large as Alera Imperia, the city of Pasia seemed airier, cleaner, more open. The crew of the tugboat Deimos hired reminded Tavi of Countess Amara, with their dark golden skin and their hair that came in several shades of deep gold, amber, and copper. The crew seemed more cheerful than the rivermen Tavi had known in the capital, and after running lines to the Slive, the smaller ship proceeded up the river, propelled by a crew of Parsian men with long poles, walking down either side of the tugboat, singing a working song with surprising facility as they did, pushing the vessels upriver. In the stern of the smaller ship was a pair of middle-aged women. They settled down on seats, slung outside the back of the tugboat, down close to the waterline. They sat dragging their feet in the water, chatting with one another, and doing handwork, mostly sewing. When Tavi asked, Deimos explained that they were the wives of the tugboat's captain and first mate, and that they were watercrafters whose furies would convince the currents of the river to pretend that the tugboat and the Slive were not there. The Gaul was busy with traffic, and would only become more so until the trading season slowed again at the end of autumn. Now that the sailors weren't needed to manage the sails, they lounged on deck for hours at a stretch, whenever Deimos couldn't fill their time with make-work. As a result, Tavi found that he and Araris had an audience for their practice sessions, and to his intense discomfort they began regularly betting on the outcomes of the practices. Not whether Tavi would beat Araris, which seemed a foregone conclusion. The wagers all centered on when and how Tavi would lose, and how much of his blood would spill in the process. The tugboat kept up its pace until several hours after dark, lighting its way with fury lamps until the boatmen were too weary to continue, and they would start moving again just as the eastern sky began to lighten. The boat moved with surprising grace and speed up the river, often passing trading caravans on the road beside the water on their way to Alera Imperia, and quietly, efficiently passed the other vessels being drawn upriver by tugs. As a result, it took them only 6 days to reach the capital.
"That's a great racket they've got going," Deimos observed as the tugboat maneuvered close to the docks and passed up the lines that would let the dockmen haul the Slive into position. "They made a quarter of what I did, just for the run up the river. No pirates, no leviathans, no worries about storms, fresh water or food."
"Maybe you're in the wrong business," Aaron observed.
"You get to be my age, you start thinking about your retirement." Deimos replied. "I like to plan ahead. I like my work, but it's going to be a little energetic for me eventually."
Tavi stepped up next to the pair of them and nodded to Deimos.
"We're going to be here 2 days, three at the most, depending on how long it takes us to—"
Deimos interrupted him with a scowl and a raised hand.
"Don't tell me. The less I know, the harder it will be to incriminate myself."
Tavi frowned at him, but nodded.
2 days, three at most, and we'll be leaving in the middle of the night."
Deimos grunted and beckoned the bosun.
"Pay the men. Shore leave until noon tomorrow. Tell Sigurd he doesn't go until the stores are refreshed."
The weather-beaten sailor nodded, then scowled at Aaron and said something quietly in Deimos's ear. Deimos listened, nodded, and frowned at Aaron. Aaron rolled his eyes, opened his purse, and flipped 2 silver coins at the bosun. The man caught them, bit them both, and nodded before stumping off to his duties.
"Sailors and their swill," Aaron muttered.
The Slive bumped against the heavy rolls of burlap cushioning the edge of the dock, and the dock rats made the ship fast. Sailors lowered the gangplank and sailors spilled off the ship, for all the world looking like students leaving a stuffy lecture hall. Aaron gave Tavi a nod and slipped off the ship among the sailors, blending into the rowdy bunch without difficulty. Deimos eyed Tavi.
You aren't going to?
Tavi glanced up at the lowering sun. In a bit.
Ah,
Deimos said, nodding.
Glad your man paid my bosun back.
Why wouldn't he? Tavi asked.
Some people have funny ideas about property, Deimos said. They think they can take it or ruin it, and that they have the right to do so. You'll pay me for those chains.
I did you a favor.
See what I mean about funny ideas? Deimos said. That's my livelihood.
No, it isn't, Tavi said. If you were primarily a slaver, your ship would smell a lot worse and you'd have had more chains. Deimos shrugged.
Worked on a slaver before I got the slive. The money's good, but I didn't like the smell. There's the occasional run, though. I carry all kinds of cargo.
People, Tavi said, are not cargo.
The excise men in all the southern ports seem to disagree with you, Deimos said dryly.
Things change, Tavi said. Slavery is going to be one of them. Deimos narrowed his eyes and stared at Tavi for a long moment. Then he said,
It hasn't changed yet. You'll pay me for those chains.
Tavi squinted at Deimos for a moment.
Or what? You'll weigh anchor and leave us here?
Deimos's eyes went flat.
Excuse me?
That's what you mean, isn't it? Tavi continued. That if I don't pay you, you'll leave us high and... Tavi never so much as saw Deimos draw his blade. It simply appeared at the end of his extended arm. What shocked him was that his own hand came up every bit as quickly, and his dagger met Deimos's blade before it could touch Tavi's skin. Then the planks of the deck suddenly shuddered beneath Tavi's feet, flinging him 6 or 8 inches into the air and robbing him of his balance. He came down windmilling his arms and wound up on his rump. One of the planks of the deck abruptly folded, supple as a willow wand, and came down over Tavi's knife hand, pinning it painfully to the deck's wooden surface. Deimos stepped forward and drove his sword into the deck between Tavi's sprawled legs, not more than 2 inches from his groin. The captain growled and squatted down to be on eye level with the young man.
"I've taken your money," he said in a tone full of quiet rage. "That means I do the job. Period. Do you understand me?"
Tavi just stared at him for a moment in shock. Then he stammered, "The ship? The whole ship is a wood fury."
"And she's mine," Deimos said. "And you will repay me for the property you damaged before this trip is over."
Behind the captain, Tavi saw Araris appear silently on bare feet, his sword in hand. He drifted closer, his face intent. The door to the cabin snapped open with sudden vicious force, striking Araris in the shoulder and sending him to the deck in a sprawl.
"And tell your swordmaster," Deimos continued, eyes never wavering from Tavi's, "that if he draws steel on me again, he'd better be smart enough not to do it aboard this vessel."
Deimos rose, drew the tip of his blade from the planks of the deck and sheathed it. Turning to Araris, he said,
"We both know you'd take me in a fair fight."
Araris rose slowly and sheathed his sword. He gave Deimos a slight bow of the head.
"When's the last time you were in a fair fight?"
Deimos made a curt gesture at the deck, and the plank pinning Tavi's arm flexed and released him, returning to its original position.
"I think I was 12. I never saw the point. Good day, gentlemen."
Tavi watched Deimos stroll away and shook his head.
"Are you all right?" Araris asked quietly. "That," Tavi said, "is a dangerous man."
Araris rubbed at his shoulder and winced in silent agreement. Tavi glanced at the sun.
"Another hour and it'll be dark enough to go. There's a boarding house on Craft Lane. We'll stay there until we can get everything we need."
Tavi frowned and lowered his voice. "How is she?"
"Better, since we've gotten away from the ocean," Araris replied.
Tavi shook his head.
The things she did, Araris. That was some major crafting. That thing with the shark? And I've never even heard of anyone moving through the water that way. I thought that the spray was going to start cutting my skin we were moving so quickly. Araris frowned. I don't remember much of it. She healed you without using a tub. Araris's eyes widened slightly.
She didn't mention that.
I saw Lady Placida do that once, Tavi said quietly. But that's all. I mean, I knew Isana was a skilled healer, even when compared to citizen healers, but this is the second time I've seen her do something on such a large scale that wasn't healing. Araris nodded slowly.
When she flooded that little river, just before Second Calderon.
Exactly. What she did out there wasn't exactly new, but it's certainly more than she's ever done before. More than even she thought she could do, I'm certain.
Araris drummed his fingers idly on the hilt of his sword. A lot of times you don't really know where your limits are until they're tested. I've known any number of people who had a tremendous gift in metalcraft, but who, for whatever reason, never used it.
He shrugged his shoulders.
How often is one called upon to hurl an attacking shark onto the deck of a pirate ship, Tavi?
Tavi flashed Araris a wry grin.
You've known her longer than I have, he said quietly. Have you ever seen anything else like this? Something that would indicate that her crafting might be a more significant gift than anyone knew?
Araris shook his head.
You mean to ask if your father ever said anything about it?
Tavi glanced away, suddenly uncomfortable.
Well, yes.
Araris folded his arms and was silent for a long moment.
It was a long time ago, and for a long time it wasn't anything I cared to dwell on.
But if there's anything you remember...
Araris held up a hand and closed his eyes for a moment. Once, when we were talking about what Sextus would say when he learned about Isana. Your father had just told me of his intention to marry her, and...
Araris glanced at Tavi, and the young man felt a flash of the Singulare's discomfort and shame.
And I told him that there would be the crows to pay if he did. Gaius wouldn't have minded a bastard or two running around. The bloodline has never been a particularly fruitful one. But he definitely had plans in mind for Septimus's wife. He'd have chosen someone not only for political gain, but for their skill at furycraft as well, to keep the royal bloodline strong.
Tavi sighed. I'm not holding advice you gave my father against you, Araris.
Bloody crows, man, you know me better than that. Just tell me what he said.
Araris nodded.
He said that Isana was more than he expected, and that she would be more than Gaius had bargained for either.
He sighed.
But he wasn't necessarily talking about her crafting.
It sounds like he was. What else could he have meant? Tavi asked.
There weren't many people willing to stand up to Septimus, but she was one of them. If she thought he was wrong, she'd call him on it. Not argue exactly, but... He could get most people to go along with him through sheer force of personality. He couldn't bull his way through Isana like that. She never raised her voice. Never really seemed to be in conflict with him. But she'd never give an inch, either.
Araris shrugged.
Tavi, your father never set much store by furycraft when it came to the important things.
He never had to work without it, either, Tavi said.
True enough.
Araris's frown deepened.
But... Tavi, I don't know if you know this, but the House of Gaius has always been gifted with... not prophecy, precisely, but a measure of insight, foresight, that went beyond what could be explained away as simple wisdom.
Tavi frowned.
I've never heard about that. It isn't something that's casually bandied about, Araris said. Septimus was particularly intuitive. He would just casually mention things that were going to happen weeks or months later. Miles used to write them down, keep track of them. Sometimes Septimus would hardly remember mentioning it. I don't think it was anything he had control over.
What's that got to do with Isana? Tavi asked.
Araris shrugged. Just that he might have made the remarks based on an intuition.
The Singulare smiled faintly.
You've got to admit, Isana's done quite a bit more than Gaius would expect out of a woman from a Steadholt. She was instrumental in the events of Second Cauldron. If not for her, in fact, Gaius would have died the night the Vord attacked his meditation chamber. And according to Countess Amara, only her warning saved her and your uncle from being killed by Kalaris's immortals, and their actions helped tilt the balance of power in Kalaris's initial attack. He shook his head. Or maybe he was talking about her fury craft. Maybe she had more power at her disposal than she knew. Or... He frowned. What? Tavi asked, intent. Or what? Or maybe... Maybe your father placed more furies at her disposal before he died.
Tavi frowned.
Could...
Can that be done?
Oh, yes, Araris said, nodding. The way furies can be passed from generation to generation on a Steadholt. Remember when old Frederick passed Thumper to young Frederick? I thought that only happened, you know, out in the country where people name their furies. As far as I know, there's no reason that someone couldn't pass more furies along to someone else, whether they were discrete beings or amorphous. It's just rarely done among the citizenry. A child with a high potential generally attracts many furies to himself all on his own, of course. Septimus certainly did. But his powers would have been significantly greater when his father died or stepped aside and willed the majority of his power to pass on.
Tavi frowned.
And what? You think my father might have willed some of his furies to her when he was killed?
Araris shook his head.
I just don't know, Tavi. But I think it's significant that both times she demonstrated extraordinary strength, your life was in danger.
His eyes went distant, and he smiled very faintly.
It would be just like Septimus to find a way to protect his son, even years after his own death.
Tavi frowned at that. Araris had said more about his father in the past moments than he had in most of the previous 2 years. It was a lot to think about. He closed his eyes for a moment as a sharp little ache went through him. Was his father still there somehow, watching over him? The very thought was incredibly reassuring, almost unbearably sad, sweetly painful. It was the kind of thing he had dreamed about when he was lonely, uncertain, or afraid. Like now. He was about to set out to break Varg out of the most secure prison in all of Alera. The Grey Tower was home to some of the most dangerous swordsmen to be found, and, partially in thanks to his own recommendations, its fury-crafted defenses were some of the most deadly to be had. And even if the rescue was successful, they would have to elude the pursuit that was sure to be sent after them. As if all of that wasn't enough, there was Varg to consider. Tavi was not at all certain what the Carnim warrior's reaction would be once he was free. Varg might well decide his best course of action would be to tear Tavi's throat out and make his own way from there. Tavi smiled faintly at Araris and said quietly, "I'll take all the help I can get." Chapter 31 For Isana, visits to the largest cities of Alera had never been pleasant. The constant pressure of the various emotions of so many people packed into one small area was a constant distraction. It was a low but steady noise, like being constantly accompanied by half a dozen nightmarishly persistent crickets. It was never horribly loud, but it didn't stop, and the intrusive sensations could make it maddeningly difficult to sleep or concentrate. Isana feared that she might desperately need all of her concentration in the hours to come. The rooms Tavi had rented for them were plain, but roomy and well kept. They were outrageously expensive by the standards of the Steadholts of the Calderon Valley, but her travels had broadened her outlook somewhat, even if they hadn't fattened her purse. By the standards of Alera Imperia, the price was more than reasonable, even if each day's rent would also have paid for the food of an entire Steadholt for a day. The boarding house, however, was apparently frequented by merchants who were particularly close about their money. Negotiations of one kind or another were in progress in rooms below and above her, as well as in the house's tiny garden, and from the feel of it, they were ferocious affairs. She tried to rest as best she could once they were there, but the constant surging flutter of the city made it problematic. Isana rose quietly from the bed in the room she shared with Kitai, slipped into her shoes, and donned her dress and cloak. Perhaps if she stretched her legs a little, she would tire enough to rest. She drifted to the window and looked out. The lane below, though it was nearly midnight, was well lit with fury lamps, and she could see two different pairs of men in the uniform of the Civic Legion patrolling. The street would be safe enough. She turned to find Kitai sitting up in her bed, stretching.
"Can't you sleep, either?" the girl asked Isana.
"No,"
Isana answered quietly. "It's the water crafting, isn't it?" Kitai said.
"Partly,"
Isana said, and the word came out with more of an edge than she had intended. She paused, softened her tone, and said, "Mostly." Kitai tilted her head. Her green eyes were almost luminous in the dim light from the street's fury lamps.
"Are you leaving the city, then?"
"I thought I'd take a walk," Isana said. "Sometimes a little exercise helps." Kitai smiled.
"I have need to walk as well. Perhaps we should do so together."
"I'd like that," Isana said. She added diffidently, "Perhaps you should put some clothes on first, dear."
Kitai's mouth turned up in a slow smile.
"Why do Alarans always insist on such things?"
10 minutes later, they were walking together down Craft Lane. The home of the majority of skilled labor in the city, the houses were almost universally dark and quiet. Few people were on the street. Those few were mostly younger men, late apprentices and early journeymen, presumably returning to their beds after time spent in less sober quarters of the city.
"Kitai,"
Isana said quietly, "there's something I've been meaning to ask you about."
"Yes?"
she asked. She wore her cloak with the hood up, hiding both her decidedly conspicuous hair and the canted eyes of her Marat heritage.
"Regarding you and Tavi."
Kitai nodded, her green eyes shining with amusement.
"Yes?"
Isana sighed. "I need to know about your relationship with him."
"Why?"
Kitai asked. Because of things I am not free to share with you, your friendship with him could cause... relations could be a factor in..." She shook her head in frustration. "What does your relationship with him mean to you, precisely? Where do you see it leading you in the future?"
"Ah," Kitai said in a tone of comprehension, "those kinds of relations. If you wished to know if we were mating, you should have asked."
Isana blinked, then stared at Kitai, mortified. She felt her cheeks burn.
"No. No, that isn't what I meant at..." "Not nearly often enough, of course," Kitai said with an exhalation somewhere between a sigh and a growl. "Not since we left the fortress. We can't on the ship. Never when the Legion was in the field."
She kicked a small stone at the buildings on the other side of the street with a scowl.
"Alarans have a great many foolish rules."
"Kitai, that isn't what..."
"He was very clumsy at first," Kitai confided. "Except for his mouth."
She smirked and added dryly,
"But then he's always been clever with that."
Isana began to feel somewhat desperate.
"It was as if no one had taught him what it was he ought to do. Which I suppose could be another problem you Alarans have. After all, if no one has any idea how to go about it, no wonder you all get so nervous just talking about it."
"Kitai," Isana said weakly.
"They started paying me for doing what I was doing anyway, in the Legion, and I considered purchasing instruction for him. It seemed as useful a purpose for spending money as any. But I was informed by the women working at the pavilion that it was improper, and that by Alaran standards, practically anything I did was going to make him happy, provided I did it naked."
She threw up her hands.
"And after all that fuss about wearing clothing in the first place."
At least no one was walking close enough to hear the conversation. Isana began to mumble something she hoped Kitai would not take as encouragement, then caught a swift brush of the girl's emotions. Isana stopped in her tracks and arched an eyebrow at Kitai. "You're teasing me?" The Marat girl's eyes shone as she glanced over her shoulder.
"Would I do such a thing to the First Lady of Alera?"
Isana felt her mouth hang open for a moment. She closed it again, and she hurried to catch up to Kitai. She was silent for several paces before she said, "He told you?"
"He may as well have," Kitai replied. "His feelings changed every time he spoke about you."
Her expression sobered.
"I remember what it felt like to have a mother. I felt it in him for you."
Isana regarded the girl for a time as they walked. Then she said quietly,
"You aren't what you appear to be at all, are you?"
Kitai arched a pale brow at her.
"You appear to be this barbarian girl, I suppose. Adventurous, bold, careless of manners and proper behavior."
Isana smiled faintly.
"I asked about your relationship with my son. You've told me a great deal about it."
Kitai shrugged a shoulder.
"My father has a saying. Speak only to those who listen. Anything else is a waste of breath. The answers to your questions were there, if you listened for them."
Isana nodded quietly. "What you have with Tavi, it's like your people's other totems, yes? The way your father is close to his gargant, Walker." Kitai's eyebrows shot up.
"Toroka was not mating with Walker when last I knew."
She paused a beat and added,
"Walker would never stand for it."
Isana felt herself laugh despite all. The Marat girl nodded at that and smiled.
"Yes, it is much the same."
She touched her heart.
"I feel him here."
"Are there others like you? With Alaran... I don't know the word for it."
"Chala,"
Kitai said.
"No. Our peoples have never been close, and whelps are usually kept safeguarded from any outsiders. I am the only one."
"But what clan would you go to?" Isana asked. "If you went back to your people, I mean." She shrugged.
"I am the only one."
Isana absorbed that for a few moments. "That must be difficult," she said quietly. "To be alone." Kitai bent her head, a small inward smile on her lips.
"I would not know. I am not alone."
Love, deep and abiding, suddenly radiated from the Marat girl like heat from a stove. Isana had felt its like before, though seldom enough, and the power of it impressed her. She had thought the barbarian girl an idle companion before now, someone who stayed near Tavi out of her sense of enjoyment and adventure. She'd misread the young woman by a great deal, assuming that the lack of emotion she generally felt from the girl had meant that there was no depth of conviction in the person behind it. "You can hide yourself, your feelings, the way he can," Isana said quietly. "You let me feel that just now. You wanted to reassure me." The Marat girl faced her, unsmiling, and bowed her head.
"You are a good listener, Lady Isana."
Isana bit her lip. "I'm hardly a lady, Kitai."
"Nonsense," Kitai said. "I have seen nothing in you to indicate that you would be anything other than one of nobility, refinement, and grace."
She pressed something into Isana's hands.
"Hold this for me."
Isana blinked as Kitai handed her a sack of heavy burlap. She looked around. The Marat girl had directed their steps while they walked, and Isana had not realized that they had left Craft Lane. She was not certain where they were now. "Why do you want me to hold this?"
"So I have something to put the cold stone in after I have burgled it," Kitai said. "Excuse me."
And with that, the girl stepped into a darkened alleyway, flicked a rope up over a chimney, and calmly scaled the outside of a building. Isana stared for a moment, aghast. Then footsteps sounded down the street, and she looked up to see a pair of civic legionaries on their patrol. For a moment, Isana nearly panicked and fled. Then she berated herself sharply and composed herself, slipping the bag underneath her cloak. The legionaries, both of them young men, dressed in leather tunics rather than the military loraica, nodded to her, and the taller of the pair said,
"Good evening, miss. Are you all right?"
"Yes," Isana said. "I am well, thank you." The shorter of the two drawled,
"On a pretty spring evening like this, why wouldn't you be? Unless you were lonely, of course."
His immediate and somewhat exuberant interest ran over her, and Isana felt her eyebrows go up. She'd spent comparatively little of her adult life in places where she wasn't known, by reputation at least, if not by sight. It hadn't occurred to her that she would be effectively anonymous here. Given the apparent youth of a powerful watercrafter, with her hood up and the strands of silver in her dark hair concealed, she would look like a young woman no older than these legionaries.
"Not lonely, sir, no," she said, "though I thank you for asking."
The taller one frowned, and a practical, professional kind of suspicion rippled across her.
"It's late for a young woman to be out alone, miss," he said. "May I ask what you're doing here?"
"Meeting a friend," Isana extemporized.
"Little late at night for that kind of thing in this part of town," the shorter legionare said.
The taller one sighed.
"Look, miss, no offense, but a lot of these young citizens from the academy book time, then don't show up for the appointment. They know they're not supposed to be seen down to the dock quarter after dark, so they promise the extra coin to get you up here, but..."
"Excuse me?" Isana said sharply. "Exactly what are you accusing me of doing, sir?" She snapped her fingers impatiently. "Your name, legionare. What is your name?" The young man seemed somewhat taken aback, and she felt his flash of uncertainty.
Melior. Miss... I don't want to—"
"Legionare, Melior," Isana said, pressing her aggression with the kind of self-assurance no younger woman could quite have matched. She reached up and lowered her hood, revealing the silver laced through her hair. "Am I to understand that you are accusing me," she gave the last word very slight emphasis, "of prostitution?" The shorter of the two frowned and returned with restrained belligerence.
"Well, why else would you be out here alone this late?" With
the taller one stepped firmly on his foot. Then he said,
"I meant no accusations, my lady, but it is my duty to keep things in order here at night."
"I assure you, young sir, that everything is in order," Isana replied firmly. "Thank you for your concern," she said, then added a slight barb to her tone. "And for your courtesy." The shorter legionare glared at his partner, then at Isana, and seemed to come to some sort of realization.
"Oh," he said. "Right."
The taller one rolled his eyes by way of apology.
"Very well, my lady," he said, and they continued on their way.
Once they were out of sight, Isana let out an enormous breath and leaned against the nearest building, shaking slightly. A fine contribution to their mission she would have made, from the inside of a cell with any other wayward ladies of the night they'd collected. For goodness sake, there was even the chance that she might have been recognized as something other than an anonymous citizen. She hadn't exactly been a celebrity during her previous visits to the capital, but there had been a number of speeches on behalf of the Dianic League. There was always the chance, however slim it might be, that she might be recognized.
"That was well done," murmured Kitai's voice.
The Marat girl came down the side of the building with the grace of a spider, landed, and dislodged her line with a flick of her wrist. She hissed as she quickly took a pouch whose neck she gripped in her teeth and held it away from her face. Little wisps of steam trailed from the pouch, and a small patch of frost had begun to form on its surface. "Quick, the bag!" Isana opened the thick burlap sack, and she realized that it was several layers thick and heavily lined, a sack designed specifically to contain the fury-bound cold stones. Kitai opened the pouch and dropped a rounded stone the size of a child's fist into the sack.
The evening air was brisk, but a deeper chill followed the cold stone, and Isana hurriedly shut the heavy sack over it.
"What have you done?" Isana asked quietly.
"Acquired something